He has returned! Yusha has returned!
The gathering was small, numbering no more than 200 shamed ones. But word of the prophet's return was spreading through the underbelly of Yuuzhan Tar, and given enough time, the audience would swell to thousands, perhaps tens of thousands. Nomanor gazed down from what had once been the elevated rail for a magnetically levitated transport to what had been a broad boulevard of nightclubs and restaurants, where his followers stood with faces raised in renewed hope and expectation. For a moment, and just that, it felt good to be back.
He has returned! Yusha has returned!
Nomanor scanned the crowd. Below the elevated track, pushing their way forward, came Kunra, Idrish, and Vitel. A shamed warrior, Kunra had been Yusha's bodyguard and chief disciple, and the only one who knew of Nomanor's visit to Tsunama Sikat.
We knew you would return,
Kunra said, when he and the others had climbed to the top of the rail.
You promised that you would elevate us once you had regained your status, and you have been escalated beyond the rank you held. You're in a position to help us beyond our boldest imaginings. Guys or not, you are indeed the prophet.
Nomanor recalled his words to Kunra and the late Ni'irit. Indeed, he had vowed to restore the honor of the Shamed Ones, if they only knew how he had betrayed them.
Yes, I promise to lift you, he said to Kunra, but we must wait a while longer. This time, I come only to warn you. Shimran knows what you're planning to do with the sacrifice, and you must trust me when I tell you that he will respond wrathfully.
Kunra spread his arms and raised them over the crowd.
Yusha says to us that we must restage our plan, that we must attack in greater numbers.
No, no,
Nomanor said while the crowd cheered.
You must rethink the plan entirely, or Shimra will eradicate you.
Kunra raised his arms again.
Shimra plans to eradicate us. We must make the first move.
Nomanor bellowed to the Shamed Ones.
You can't look to me, the Jedi, or anyone else to deliver you from your lowly stations. None of us can repair your disfigurements or modify your rejected enhancements. Yusha calls on us to accept that our blemishes are only surface imperfections, and that we must look past them to see our true selves,
Kunra said.
He tells us to follow the authority of our inner selves, to steer by our inner rudders for all important decisions, rather than pray to the gods, consult with the priests, or fear what actions the warriors and intendants might take against us.
A chill passed through Nomanor. He finally understood what Kunra was doing. Kunra, who had saved his life after an assassination attempt by Shunmi Esh, and who burned with a warrior's fire, was not about to let Nomanor shrink from the promise he had made. What was supposed to have been a final sermon had become a contest of wills.
Well done, Yusha, Kunra said quietly. The multitudes are heated to the point of boiling over. We couldn't have done this without you.
Han's blaster bolt caught the Yuuzhan Vong in his unprotected armpit, twirling him fully around and sending him plummeting from the shoulders of two warriors who had been providing unintentional support. With the immediate threat eliminated, the faceless rocket man raised his left arm and fired a small grappling hook from his forearm gauntlet. The hook found purchase on an expansion girder, instantly towing him to the ceiling of the hold, out over the extended arms of swarming warriors and through flights of blunt amphistaffs. Clambering into a crouch on the girder, he gazed down on his would-be captors, then armed his backpack missile launcher.
He's going to fire!
One step ahead of C-3PO, Han and Leia each grabbed one of the droid's arms and yanked him down to the deck. The projectile exploded in the center of the hold, flattening everyone within a radius of 10 meters. 50 or more stunned or dying Yuuzhan Vong warriors formed the circumference of the detonation zone. But reinforcements were already on the way. Han heard them surging down the corridor, crying for blood. He got to his feet, then helped Leia and C-3PO to theirs. Simultaneous with the snap hiss of Leia's lightsaber came the drone of launched thudbugs. Leia fielded those she could. Taken by surprise, a dozen Kalula soldiers were dropped in their tracks. The volley of deflected bugs flew back down the corridor at the approaching Yuuzhan Vong, only to be returned by several warriors at the head of the pack. Han caught a glimpse of five comparatively short warriors, smeared head to toe in black blood, rather than sheathed in the usual arthropod armor. Odder still was the way they were holding their amphistaffs to parry thudbugs and blaster bolts. "They're using them like lightsabers," Han said. "That seems to be the idea," Leia replied breathlessly. Han shook his head in incredulity. "More new models? I don't think we should wait around to ask." The Mandalorian armored cadre apparently felt the same. Taking aim on a portion of bulkhead close to the deck, two of the troopers used missiles to blow a gaping hole into the adjoining hold. The Kalula defenders began to scramble through, with C-3PO, Leia, and Han bringing up the rear. They raced through the adjacent hold and into a wide corridor, lowering blast shields wherever they encountered them. Greeted with an intersection, Han knew enough to ask.
"That way,"
C-3PO said. Han gave a last glance at the armored fighters, then turned to follow Leia and C-3PO. Farther along, Garay's meaty adjutant motioned them from the pack of withdrawing soldiers.
"Captain, Princess Leia, the Falcon is ready for departure."
Han stared at him. "You've got to be kidding." He gestured broadly.
"It's worse out there than in here."
"I concur, sir. Nevertheless, she's patched up and ready to go. Nowhere near good as new, but you should be able to limp her to Mon Calamari in a couple of micro-jumps."
"Everybody get on board," Han said, "before we end up EV without a ship."
When Pash Kraken and a few of the other officers didn't move, he stormed over to them.
"You waiting for a formal invitation?"
Kraken almost smiled.
"With all due respect, Han, we've decided to remain here and do what we can."
Han compressed his lips and shrugged.
"Pash, this is bigger than Kalula, and you know it. Alliance Command is counting on you people to rally support in your home systems. Besides, you can't make a difference here. Those are evacuation klaxons you're hearing."
"Han's right, Major," Leia said. Kraken still didn't move.
"We'll take our chances, Princess."
She blew out her breath.
"Your father's never going to forgive us, Pash. He'll understand."
Han nodded. "Then may the Force be with all of you. In other circumstances, I might make the same choice." He turned, and without a backward look, hurried Leia and C-3PO up the landing ramp. He told Leia to begin the startup sequence, and he sent Kak-Mame and Miwal to the gun turrets. Han leapt into the pilot's chair while Leia lifted the Falcon, turned her about, and sent her streaking through the magcon field. Local space was cross-cut with magma projectiles and turbo laser bolts. Dead ahead, the bloated Inca floated motionless in space, amid a debris cloud created by coral skippers that had thrown themselves against Kalula shields. X-Wings and other starfighters drifted lazily. Three of the station's modules were wide open to vacuum and expressing what little atmosphere they still contained. Below, explosions were blossoming on the beige and green surface of Kalula itself, with wounded coral skippers plunging into the atmosphere like fiery meteors. Han watched a dozen escape vehicles launch from an undamaged module. Kalula was finished.
"Three skips converging on us," Leia glanced at him. "It's our old friends."
Han's eyes darted to the authenticator screen.
"The ones that tracked us from Selvaris? What is this, a personal vendetta?"
One of the curved-tailed, tandem-piloted coral skippers appeared in the wraparound viewport, coming straight at the Falcon.
"Take the shot," Han said into the intercom.
Singularities formed in advance of the approaching skip, but sheer firepower overwhelmed them, and the vessel came apart in roiling fire.
"Kakmane is really getting good," Leia said.
Han shook his head negatively.
"That wasn't him."
He leaned back in his seat to glance through the upper panes of the viewport. A classic Firespray-class security patrol craft shot overhead. A cross-shaped ship affixed to an oval engine suite. It was followed by four gladiators, so named because they looked like swords thrust to the hilt through circular shields.
It is Fett, and he's clearing a lane for us, Han snorted. Just like him to make sure he has the upper hand on a debt.
Incoming transmission, Leia said. From the fire spray. Boba Fett's voice crackled through the comm.
Just wanted to remind you, Solo, that my personal fight was always with the Jedi. You were nothing more than cargo.
Han snorted.
For what it's worth, Fett, you were never more than a nuisance.
Fett laughed shortly.
To better days, Captain.
Count on it.
With the Jedi Knights reduced to half their strength since the start of the war, Luke Skywalker 7 incommunicado in the unknown regions. Some, including the 20 or so Jedi children still sheltered at the Maw installation, and others participating in various Galactic Alliance military operations. Kenth Hamner could gather only a dozen Jedi for the meeting held in Trissina Lobby's quarters on Mon Calamari. Gradually they seated themselves at the table, except for Kenth, who was too restless to eat or stay put. Clockwise from Trissina's armchair sat Silgal, Jaina, Kip, towering ginger-furred Lobaka, the Twi'lek female Alima Rar, salt-and-pepper-haired combat instructor Kyle Katarn, Chandrillan Octoramus, slight and terribly scarred Waxarn Kel, and young and darkly handsome Zek. Some of you might not be aware that Operative Baljos Arnjak didn't return from Wraith Squadron's infiltration mission to Coruscant, Kenth said as he circled the table. Bindi Drayson was supposed to have remained on world, but it was Arnjak who stayed, and has been furnishing the Alliance with intelligence ever since, mostly with the help of a kind of droid fungus he and his teammates let loose during the mission. Kenth came to a stop between Silgal and Jaina, then leaned forward, planting the palms of his hands on the table. Arnjak's latest report states that Yushaw, the so-called prophet of the heretics, was recently seen in Coruscant. By recent, I mean within the past local week, since it took that long for a string of couriers to move the information from the core to Mon Calamari. Has his identity been verified? Kyle asked from across the table. Kenth nodded, which means that he either didn't go to Zanama Sikat with Korn and Tahiri, or that he returned without them, Kip said. Is there some way we can establish whether he arrived back on Coruscant in the same vessel everyone left on?
No, Kenth said. But Arnjak also stated that neither Nen Yim nor Harar had been accounted for.
I don't like the sound of that, Zek said. Unless the Shaper and the Priest decided to stay on Zanama Sikat.
If any of them even arrived,
Lobaka's voice issued from his droid translator. Kenth glanced at the Wookiee. Exactly. Unlike most of the Holonet transceivers, Esfandia is still functioning, if inconsistently. So, assuming nothing has befallen Jade Shadow, Luke and Mara should have been able to contact us.
We've waited long enough, Octoramus said. It's time we sent a ship.
Everyone fell silent for a long moment. Then Silgal said,
I doubt that we'll find Zanama Sikat at the coordinates to which we've been transmitting messages. I suspect that the living world has moved.
Based on what?
Alima asked.
Silgal spread her webbed hands. On what the Force tells me.
Kenth glanced around the table. Do any of you also feel that way?
I do,
Jaina said. Jason feels farther away than he did when we received Luke and Mara's transmission. She shook her head somberly.
I don't feel him as distinctly.
Kenth straightened and adopted a determined expression.
We'll give Master Skywalker a week. If we don't hear from him by then, I'll assemble a strike team.
Its balloon-like bone-white outriggers buffeted by gusting winds, the airship moved swiftly over the devastated surface of Zanama Sikat. Luke, Mara, Jason, and the Yuuzhan Vong priest Harar were crammed onto the rear portion of the gondola's tiny cabin. Saba Sebatine and a Faroan male named Krojib had the controls. Next to the two pilots stood Jabatha, wrapped in a fur-lined cloak. It was she whom had suggested a day earlier where they might find Sikat. At 3,000 meters, the air was frigid, and the howling wind made conversation difficult.
Even if that hadn't been the case, no one seemed inclined to talk.
Luke raised the cowl of his robe and shoved his hands deep into the robe's sleeves. For the 10th time since the airship journey had begun, Luke tried to see Harar in the Force, but perceived only an absence. Despite Vergere's assurances to the contrary, Harar, and by extension all Yuuzhan Vong, did not seem to exist in the Force. Harar seemed to feel Luke's eyes on him and turned. His own eyes were moist, and tears had left streaks on his tattooed cheeks.
"I am overcome," he said sadly. "Even with all its recent injuries, this is the world I have dreamed of. The world all my people have dreamed of. The one that ordained our past. The one we prayed would prefigure our future. A world of symbiosis rather than competition and predation. The very world we have tried time and again to recreate, only to end up with facsimiles. It is no small wonder I felt nostalgic for this place the moment we landed. That I felt I'd arrived home, though I'd never been here."
"If the Yuuzhan Vong evolved on a world like this," Luke said, "what turned you to war?"
Harar took a moment to reply.
"The ancient texts are unclear. It appears that we were invaded by a race that was more technological than animate. We called on the gods for protection, and they came to our aid, providing us with the knowledge we needed to convert our living resources to weapons. We defeated the threat, and, empowered by our victory, we gradually became conquerors of other species and civilizations."
At Jabatha's direction, Krojib and Saba piloted the airship down toward the expansive talus field of a mountain that struck Luke as being younger than Ben and twice as unpredictable.
"Here is where my father's fortress once stood," Jabatha explained, after the airship had been anchored to the denuded slope. "Sikot showed Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker a mental image of the fortress as it was, before the advent of the Far Outsiders."
Luke asked Saba to remain with Krojib in the airship. Then he and the rest emerged from the cabin and began to follow Jabatha uphill, fighting a cold, strong wind that swept down from the invisible summit. Luke saw the cave entrance before Jabatha drew everyone's attention to it. The air inside was warm and remarkably humid. The cave angled down into the mountainside, and Luke realized immediately that what they were in was actually an ancient lava tube. The floor was paved with coarse pebbles that crunched underfoot.
"Stop there," the voice of Sikot said, speaking through a suddenly transfixed Jabatha. "Who walks with you, Jedi Master? Two I recognize, but the third..."
"He is called Harar," Luke said, not to Jabatha, but to the tunnel itself. "He came to Zonama in the company of the one who sabotaged you."
Jabatha turned to Harar. "How is it I seem to know this one? My memories go back billions of turnings, and this one carries a message to me of distant times and distant events."
"Harar is of the people you know as the Far Outsiders," Luke said.
"The Yuuzhan Vong, who tried to conquer Zonama shortly before the arrival of Vergere."
Jabatha shook her head.
"Those times are not distant, Jedi Master. But why can't I perceive him? Not as I do the children of the Firsts, not nearly as I do the Jedi. Yes, I recall having the same experience with the Far Outsiders. They seem to exist outside the Force."
"No, Sikot," Luke said. "Even though you can't perceive Harar, he exists within the Force." Jason's right hand went to his chest, as if to touch the scar left from the piece of slave coral Vergere had implanted in him. He swung to Harar.
"Why did the Yuuzhan Vong leave their home galaxy?"
Harar firmed his scarred lips, then said,
"Some have interpreted the ancient text to suggest that we were banished."
"For what reason?" Jason persisted.
"Our infatuation with war and conquest. Some interpret our long journey as an attempt to win back the favor of the gods."
Jason thought about it. "Your ancestors were banished because they turned to war. They did the opposite of what was expected of them."
"Did the gods banish you from the Force?"
When Harar lifted his head, his face was a mask of fearful confusion.
There is nothing in our legends about the Force.
Luke took Harar by the shoulders, as if to shake him, but only eased him to his feet.
A power, call it the gods if you have to, may have separated you from the original symbiosis. Your people experienced intolerable pain, and pain has been the only way back to that symbiosis.
Harar nearly collapsed in Luke's grip.
Separated from the symbiosis, from our primordial homeworld.
Luke dropped his hands to his sides and turned in astonishment to Jabatha, as if waiting for Seacott to confirm what he was thinking.
I now understand,
Seacott said finally.
This one, his people, has been stripped of the Force.
There hadn't been a ceremony to equal it in untold generations. As vast as the worldships were, and notwithstanding the views of distant stars and even more distant galaxies, they weren't large enough to contain the magnificence of high ritual. Compared to Yuuzhan Tar's place of sacrifice, the worldships were mere theaters. And yet, for all the grandeur and spectacle, Noma Nor was too consumed by apprehension to appreciate a moment of it. Located midway between Shimra Citadel and the skull-shaped bunker that housed the Well of the World Brain, the place of sacrifice was dominated by a 100-meter-high truncated cone of Yorick Karl, helixed with carved stairways and honeycombed with passageways that served to channel blood into fonts and other basins. Since the priests had not yet grown to trust Yuuzhan Tar's world brain, the matched pair of consuming beasts known as Tuskart and Skauru waited in the wings with their handlers, in case the capricious Duryam failed to command the Maw Lure to execute their tasks. More specialized than Yamasks, Duryams had full responsibility for world-shaping. Their decisions were based on the continuous streams of data they received from planet-wide networks of telepathically linked creatures. But Yuuzhan Tar's Duryam had been behaving as if there were glitches in the data flow, and it had already ruined several sacrifices by spewing fetid-smelling wastes from the Maw Lure. Noma Nor and some of Yuuzhan Tar's consuls entered the place of sacrifice to music that was at once solemn and celebratory. Sated on Yanskak and snack beetles, and mildly intoxicated on Sparkbee Honeygrog and other homebrews, the crowds of onlookers applauded exuberantly. Thousands of warriors kneeled to both sides of the grand avenue, heads lowered and amphistaffs curled sedately around their extended right arms, fists planted solidly on the ground. Regardless, Noma Nor continued to torment himself with worry. Behind the intendants marched elites of the four castes, High Priest Jaqen and his coven of savants, Red Cloak War Master Nas Choka, and 36 of supreme commanders. Master Shaper Keela Quad and her chief adepts, and High Prefect Drathul, baton of high office in hand and leading his cabal of personal consuls. Last came Shimra, without Anami, for as a shamed one, Anami was barred from attending such weighty proceedings, but accompanied by his quartet of hideous seers. At the appointed moment, when the sun had reached a place in the sky from which he could set the Rainbow Bridge aflame, the captives were led into the complex by a parade of Ingden handlers and Chazrak troops, riding 12-legged Quinac beasts. Counting what the Peace Brigaders had managed to deliver, and those captured only 3 standard days earlier at Kalula, the captives numbered close to 1,000. Military officers, political officials, soldiers, and protesters from scores of worlds along the invasion corridor. Men, women, a few adolescents who had fought bravely enough to be rewarded with honorable death. They had been purged, bathed, perfumed, mildly sedated with sensor slug gas, and blessed with Tishwi leaf smoke. Guards began to force the captives to ascend the staircases. Despite their sedation, they floundered and fought, showing no appreciation for the honor that had been bestowed on them. In the end, though, there was little they could do to affect their fate. The first of the captives had reached the circular platform when a howl rose from below. With nearly half the audience of elites rising to their feet, Noma Nor couldn't see what was going on. Then he realized what was actually happening. As if detonating, carefully camouflaged chuka caps were popping from the quadrangle's hexagonal paving stones. The shells of an aquatic creature,
The caps conceal the entrances to shafts that must have descended into the maze of canyons below the place of sacrifice. Out of the shafts were emerging hundreds of shamed ones, Yusha's flock of heretics, armed with amphistaffs, kufis, an array of homemade weapons, even a few blasters. Momentarily taken off their guard, the warriors, many in ceremonial armor only, were slow to react, and dozens were felled in an instant. As the shamed ones spread out into the crowd, the commoners began to panic, surging down into the quadrangle. Fearing that the heretics had come for Shimra, the slayers closed ranks around the supreme overlord, unfurling their amphistaffs, heedless of any who might be standing in front of them. But Nomanor saw that only a small contingent of shamed ones was closing on Shimra's dais, and that this group was clearly a diversion. It was the prisoners the heretics had come for. Oblivious, thinking perhaps that it was all a hallucination, the captives were being scooped off their feet by bands of heretics and rushed back into the labyrinthine underworld from which the pariah army had climbed. Not all of them made it to safety. Scores were dropped by Thud and Razor Bugs, along with three times as many shamed ones. Pressed among the crowd, Nomanor readied his venom-spitting eyeball. Drathul was already shouldering his way through the throng, brandishing his baton. Drathul was almost within arm's reach of Nomanor when the Supreme Overlord's voice rang out above the melee of droning Thud Bugs, snapping amphistaffs, and sizzling blaster bolts, his huge head rising above those slayers that made up his living fence.
I, Prefect Drathul, no more of this shall we brook. At this place is our patience and goodwill sundered.
Everyone in the vicinity was cowering, except for Nomanor, because of how tightly he was wedged in place. Perhaps that was why he alone happened to be gazing past Shimra when one of the slayers slipped away into the crowd. Except that the individual wasn't a slayer. Master of disguise that he was, Nomanor recognized that the deserter was wearing an Ooglith masker, which not only cloaked his appearance, but also reshaped his body. And from the way the slayer moved, with a somewhat trembling gait, the imposter could only be Anami. Approaching Mon Calamari world from well beyond its solitary moon, Han and Leia were greeted by the sight of an enormous, perhaps unprecedented gathering of warships. A unified force of battle groups, flotillas, and fleets from all regions of the galaxy. Bothan, Bakurin, Imperial Remnant, and Chiss. Sullustan, Happen, Ariadwin, and Hutt. Corellian and Mon Calamarian. Wordlessly, the Falcon maneuvered through corridors formed by the massive ships. A large crowd had turned out to welcome the Falcon home, and cheers and applause filled the scrubbed air as Han, Leia, and their roster of very influential people descended the boarding ramp. Jaina rushed from the sidelines to hug her parents for dear life. Jaina talked nonstop for the several minutes it took them to ascend to Ral Roost's command deck and ride a skimmer to a conference cabin amidships. Han and Leia were disappointed to learn that the Jedi still hadn't heard from Luke, Mara, Jason, or the others. It wasn't like them to remain out of contact for so long. The white-furred Bothan Admiral, Traest Kreefe, rose from his chair at the end of the long conference table as Leia, Jaina, and Han were being escorted into the cabin space. His violet eyes took in Han and Leia, and he smiled broadly. We were all starting to wonder if you decided to take unannounced leave. Well, we have our own idea about what constitutes a vacation, Han joked. Leia managed to smile, but just barely. By all, Kreefe had meant the dozen high-ranking officers who were seated at the table. Defense Force Supreme Commander Cian Sov, Grand Admiral Galad Pellion, Generals Wedge Antilles, Garm Bel Iblis, Kian Farlander, Carlist Riakin, and Aaron Kraken. Commodore Brand, Queen Mother and Jedi Knight Tennel Kaa, and bulky Major General Eldo Davip, promoted as a result of his brave actions aboard the Star Destroyer Lusankia at the Battle of Borlaeus. Pash was one of the officers captured at Galula Orbital and taken to Coruscant, Kraken said to Leia. But I'm hoping for the best. No one knows Coruscant better than my son, and if anyone can escape, it'll be him. Han, Leia, and Jaina found seats for themselves. Just to catch you up, Kreefe said.
This sacrifice ceremony took place as scheduled. But our agents report that before anyone had been put to the Khufi, there was an uprising by several hundred heretics. The heretics managed not only to interfere with the ceremony, but also to abscond with more than 300 Alliance prisoners.
Just to spoil things for Shimra?
Han asked. We're not sure at this point. However, we have also learned the purpose of the original sacrifice was to ensure victory for the armada Shimra plans to launch against Mon Calamari.
Han and Leia pretended to be surprised by the news.
Do we know when or how they're going to do this? Leia asked.
Sov spoke to the question.
Intelligence has determined that the enemy plans to attack directly from the Perlemian trade route. Secondary salients will be launched from Tungul and Kalula, both of which now host Yamisks.
Han glanced around the cabin.
How many Yuuzhan Vong vessels are we talking about?
On the order of 5,000.
Bel Iblis supplied flatly, the fingers of his left hand smoothing his drooping mustache. Han sat away from the table in shock.
Then we haven't a chance.
Not force against force, Sov said. But we have high confidence that the enemy has made a strategic blunder by opting to stage from remote worlds like Tungul and Kalula.
Bel Iblis nodded in agreement.
More important, we think we can take advantage of the fact the Yuuzhan Vong are expecting us to turn tail and scatter. Without going into detail at this time, Sov said, let me just add that we plan to give all appearances of being caught unawares by the armada and of engaging it head-on. This alone will give the enemy pause. In fact, half our forces will have already relocated to Khontrum, which has agreed to serve as our staging area, thanks to the efforts of General Kraken. We're counting on Captain Page to prevail on the leaders of Koralag to do the same.
What is your intention? Leia asked. Crafy cleared his throat meaningfully.
By devoting only half our battle group to the defense of Mon Calamari, the remainder will be free to move against our primary target, Coruscant.
Everyone in the Raw Roost briefing center had fallen silent in response to the hologram Admiral Crafy had conjured from a projector. Shimmering in diaphanous blue light were images of a world engulfed by vines, giant ferns, and trees with enormous fronds, some fan-shaped, some as delicate as feathers. Spires and pinnacles and flat-top bluffs rose from the luxuriant vegetation, and in the distance, immense mountains heaved, their alloy bones protruding through the verdant cloaks that had been thrown over them, and their faces marred by geometric openings.
Coruscant,
Crafy told his audience of several hundred Alliance officers. At the touch of Crafy's left forefinger, a second hollow superimposed itself on the first, showing the Senate, Kalakur Heights, Column Commons, the Glitani Esplanade, and other once-celebrated locations of the former galactic capital.
You can see that things have changed, the Bothan added.
Seated to one side of the command rostrum, Han and Leia remained as thoughtfully silent as everyone else.
Sunku, Kuninku, Amkita.
You undermine your own argument for attacking Coruscant,
a Hutt said from front row center.
Taishang Nye.
Clearly, the planet is beyond restoration. From what we have been given to understand, the Yuuzhan Vong even managed to alter the orbit and rotation.
Why should we waste our dwindling resources on rescuing Coruscant in any case?
An Agamarian officer said.
What did the New Republic Senate do for us when the Yuuzhan Vong invaded? They hung us out to dry. They allowed the worlds of the Outer and Midrims to fall, while they recalled the fleets to protect the core.
Question, Admiral Crafy. Said a wing commander Han didn't know by name. I thought we won the war to Bach Nine.
That's not a question, Crafy grumbled. But I'll address it anyway. The war will not be won until we've retaken Coruscant. Our crusade is not only justified, but essential. Coruscant cries out for vengeance.
Our resistance leaders on Coruscant maintain that the time is ripe, Aaron Kraken said. The Shamed Ones are ready to make their move. Intelligence now believes that Alliance prisoners were rescued not for sacrifice or hostage-taking, but as a means of sending a signal that the heretics are ready to ally with us in the fight. Shimra is well aware of the fact that he is fighting on two fronts, and his planned attack on Mon Calamari smacks of desperation. He knows that he needs to defeat us before we succeed in amassing a force sufficient to threaten him, or before the heretics conspire to pitch him from the throne. The audience stirred, but no one had questions.
I wish to speak for a moment about the attack on Mon Calamari itself, Crafy said.
Again, the Bothan's hand went to the holoprojector controls. The 3D image showed a pliable-looking, bulbous-headed marine-looking creature, trailing a mass of tentacles of varying length and thickness.
A Yamask, Crafy said. The gigantic, genetically engineered creature that serves as a war coordinator for the Yuuzhan Vong. Analysis of recent battle recordings suggests that the Yuuzhan Vong armada will take the form of this monstrosity, with warships, gunship analogs, and coral skippers strung out to represent tentacles, and capital ships, tenders, carriers, and actual Yamask vessels comprising the armada's fortified heart.
Crafy's light pointer indicated the tentacles.
Our strategy will be to sow confusion in these key areas by using our fastest ships to strike and fade, gradually opening fire lanes to the center. These attacks will commence the moment the armada emerges from hyperspace. As the main body of the armada nears Mon Calamari space, the ranged weapons of our largest ships will begin to hammer away at the center. Concurrently, courier ships will be dispatched to Kontroom, where our fleets will be standing by. We anticipate that when the Yuuzhan Vong commander at Mon Calamari learns that Coruscant is under siege, he will attempt to jump some of his battle groups back to the core by way of Tungul and Kalula, trusting the Yamasks installed on those worlds to coordinate withdrawal and protect against the possibility of ambush.
With all due respect, Admiral, a Mon Calamari officer said, Nas Choka is a far more shrewd warmaster than Savang La was. He won't be taken in by intelligence disinformation. And at Tungul and Kalula, he'll be on the watch for interdictors, or mines of the sort we employed successfully at Ibak 9.
Precisely, Crafy said, which is why we'll employ none of that. Instead, Alliance infiltration teams will by then have incapacitated the Yamasks on both worlds. Deprived of battle coordination, the withdrawing battle groups will be vulnerable to counterattack. The odds are against our inflicting sufficient damage to rout them. But the longer we can keep them from returning to the core, the greater the chances of our Kontroom fleets scoring heavily against Coruscant and against Shinra.
Nas Choka pushed through the living membrane that sealed the command grotto from prying eyes. A trio of Supreme Commanders and their subalterns trailed in the War Master's angry wake.
Our course is now set,
he announced to his own subalterns and tacticians.
Supreme Overlord Shimra will abide no farther delay. We are enjoined to launch the armada in 3 local days, when the auguries are favorable for victory.
3 days, fearsome one,
the tactician said when Nas Choka had dropped cross-legged onto his Yorick coral bench.
The burden is mine, Nas Choka replied abruptly. Don't add to it by echoing my words. Tender your report.
The tactician inclined his head in a bow of respect.
Rumors teem like an infestation of sackworms. From all sectors comes word of heightened enemy activity. Ships masquerading as spice carriers leave hot space, but as often as not they are empty. The same holds true in Bothan space. There is increased traffic within the Happen cluster, with many ships inbound from Kashyyyk and from the more distant remnant. Known operatives and agents consort clandestinely on Corellia and Bimisari. Courier ships of the Smugglers Alliance arrive and depart Kontroom, with a few venturing as close to Yuuzhan'tar as Korolag.
Sheer impudence, Nas Choka said, and at Mon Calamari.
Almost half the fleet has departed. Many capital ships have returned to their home sectors. Others have been traveling in and out of dark space. Still others have been deployed as substitutes for the transceiving devices our Dovan Basals engulfed.
What of the Yamasks at Tungul and Kalula?
Unperturbed, fearsome one. Although...
Nas Choka waited, then said,
Give voice to it.
Kalula, surrender, War Master. Before the fall of the orbital station, the commander who led our assault was contacted by the governor of the planet. The governor promised that Kalula would yield to occupation without need of an amphistaff being raised against it.
There is nothing unusual about that,
the warrior seer interrupted.
Yes, seer, but in the instance of Kalula, the governor made a special request. She asked for permission for scientists to visit, to observe some sort of natural spectacle peculiar to the planet. This, of course, would necessitate the temporary maintenance of the spaceport for the landing of ships and scientific personnel.
Nos Choka folded his massive arms.
Our commander agreed to this?
The tactician nodded.
Who commands the Yamask emplacement at Kalula?
I can provide the answer momentarily, War Master.
Nos Choka paced to his bench.
Return not only with the name, but also with the commander's dedicated villip. I need speak with him as well.
The Yuuzhan Vong warrior at Kalula spaceport made it clear that he was ready to unleash his amphistaff at the slightest provocation. The sight of the tattooed and scarred warrior standing against a backdrop of shuttles and landing craft was just absurd enough to widen Han's eyes, but he knew better than to smile. Several Yuuzhan Vong warships were in orbit above Kalula, though not nearly as many as Han had expected to see.
You are the scientist, Melok Yu.
The warrior said in basic to the female Ho Din, on whom the entire infiltration mission rested. More than 2 meters tall, with sucker-equipped four-fingered hands, a purple crown of erect thermographic receptors, and a reptilian-complected lipless face, she might almost have been a Yuuzhan Vong shaper.
Yes, I am Melok Yu, she answered in Yuuzhan Vong.
The warrior extended a sinewy hand.
Your authentication.
Melok Yu displayed the fist-sized nugget of flesh and fur that had been delivered to her on Obroaskai. The warrior took the creature between his hands, squeezed it, and studied the pungent droppings it left on a piece of leathery parchment. Then he nodded and motioned to Han, Leia, Kip, Judder Page, and the Bothan intelligence officer, Raw.
The members of my support team, Melok Yu said. Their names should also be contained by the lumpen.
Having lived among the Yuuzhan Vong for close to 4 years on the enemy-occupied library world, she knew how to deal with them, as well as speak to them. The warrior squeezed the lumpen so hard it squealed, and another batch of droppings fell to the parchment. It took a moment for the warrior to confirm that the names and descriptions detailed in the droppings matched the counterfeit identities of the humans and humanoids in front of him, but ultimately, he nodded again.
The lumpen will remain here until your departure. If all of you have not returned in 3 days, you will be hunted down, imprisoned, and punished for your insolence. Do you understand?
Yes,
Melok Yu answered for all of them.
Then proceed inside.
A surprise to everyone, and some cause for suspicion, Yuuzhan Tar had granted permission for a few select scientists to visit Kalula to observe what was called the Nocturne of the Winged Stars, an allegedly extraordinary natural phenomenon that occurred once every 300 standard years. As Han understood it, the local governor had cut the deal in secret, even while the orbital station was still under siege.
I'm through with travel, if it means carrying a lumpen instead of an identichip,
Raw said to Han while they were entering the spaceport terminal.
We're here to make sure you don't have to, Han said. We've got enough unhappy Bothans without adding you to the list.
Where Yuuzhan Vong warriors and Bisop hounds held sway over the landing field, peace brigaders, Nikto, Weequays, and a couple of Gamorreans and other alien traitors oversaw luggage inspection and terminal security. Team Melok Yu's equipment was being pawed through by a Klatooinian and a Kodra G, whose forearms were buried to the elbows in Han's backpack. The Yuuzhan Vong had prohibited the import or use of recording devices other than sketch pads and writing implements, but they had allowed tents and camping gear, since the expeditions were destined for the rugged mountains that walled Kalula City on three sides. As rudimentary as they were, the Brigader's scanners were capable of detecting most weapons, so blasters had been left off the packing list. Leia's and Kip's lightsabers, however, were included among the cooking supplies, disguised as handles for self-warming fry pans. The Klaatu-Inian put the field kitchen duffel on the inspection table. Kip stepped up to the table and made a subtle hand motion. "You don't need to inspect this bag." The canine-faced humanoid stared at the Jedi and blinked his heavy-lidded eyes.
"We don't need to inspect this bag."
Momentarily confused, the Qadra G eventually nodded in agreement. "Gather your belongings and leave.
Gather your belongings and leave."
No sooner had they exited the terminal than clouds of indigenous flitnets surrounded them.
"Hope you remember to pack the repellent," Han said to Leia.
"What in hell?"
Raw rasped.
"Every visitor to Kalula gets assigned 100 flitnets, and those 100 stick with you for your entire stay."
Han laughed shortly at the Bothan's joke.
"Well, everybody's got their own idea about what makes a good vacation."
What Han didn't say was that the tiny pests were already sticking to the cosmetic that lightened his complexion and the adhesive that secured his gray beard, mustache, and woolly eyebrows. Leia was the only other one also in disguise, her hair concealed under a wig of closely cropped silver locks, and her skin a faint shade of green, thanks to some pill intelligence had had her swallow.
"Here come our guides," Paige said.
A Rodian and a Rin, they were wearing rustic trousers and shirts, beat-up footwear, fabric belts, and tight-fitting woven skullcaps. And clearly they were comfortable around the saddled mounts they rode and led. The size of small dewbacks, the long-snouted quadrupeds were nearly as shaggy as banthas, but lacked horns or tusks of any sort.
"I'm Sasso," the Rodian said, as the pair came within earshot of Han and the others.
"Furfur,"
the Rin said, under his breath, adding,
"Gatherer 164 out of Balmora."
Sasso pointed Han to his mount, which was known locally as a Timbu. Han planted his foot in the stirrup and pulled himself onto the immense saddle. The Timbu grunted and turned his big, floppy-eared head to regard Han through a liquid black eye. Team MelloQ moved out.
"How far to the Yamisk?" Kip asked Sasso. "The installation is practically the new city center, probably to discourage attempts at orbital bombardment. But our safest approach is from the south, which means crossing two ranges of hills to get there."
"The weapons are cached along our route?" Paige said.
"There are weapons buried everywhere," Sasso told him. "As soon as it became obvious that the Vong were interested in occupying Kalula, we began hiding as much as we could. Blasters, foods, droids, you name it."
Sasso brought the train of 8 Timbus to a halt at the foot of a steep uphill track that disappeared into a thickly forested ravine. A winged creature passed soundlessly overhead, disappearing into the trees before Han could get a good look at it.
"Yuuzhan Vong by it," Furfur said nervously. "We're being watched."
Still wearing her silver-locked wig, Leia was deflating Han's and her sleeping pad when she saw Sasso drop something by the smoldering campfire. A leathery creature about the size of a shock ball, it looked like a villip with wings, and this one had been pierced by a wooden quarrel fired from the Rodian's crude bowcaster-like weapon.
"That's one that won't be able to report on us," Sasso said,
examining his fresh kill with the thoroughness of a born hunter. Leia went over to the fire to have a closer look at the dead creature. "The Bayat we saw yesterday?"
"Maybe not the same one, but from the same flock."
Sasso's green snout twitched.
"Got it on the first try. That's never happened before."
Kalula's sun had been up for an hour, but the ravine's forest of cane trees was still waking up. Under cover of darkness, Sasso and the Rin Furfur had sneaked off to a nearby supply cache and returned by first light with a bowcaster and a couple of weapons old enough to have been carried by Leia's adoptive father's bodyguards, including a thick-barreled blaster with a large hardwood hand grip, another with a finger-contoured grip and built-in scope, two black military-grade hand weapons with trigger guards and top-mounted heat radiators, and a rifle Han identified as a DC-15 with a folding stock. The blasters were now stashed in the duffels, but not so deeply they couldn't be retrieved in a hurry. Melikyu and the mustachioed Furfur returned to camp just as Han and Ra were about to secure the gear bags to the Timbus. The docile animals were foraging for food in the tall grass. The stately Hodin female looked disappointed. "Couldn't find any wing star shells?" Han said. She shook her head.
"We found hundreds, but all of them were inactive. At least some should have opened by now."
Just then, Paige and Kip returned to camp. "We found signs of a Yuuzhan Vong patrol," Paige reported. "Tracker beasts, and a couple of those 12-legged mounts."
"Bisseps and quinacs," Sasso said, getting to his feet. "We'd better get moving. The sooner we cross the next ridge, the better."
Everyone pitched in to load the remaining gear. With Furfur riding point, they climbed to the crest of the ridge, then began a slow switchback descent through dense forest. Sasso, Paige, and Kip rode ahead to scout the trail. Halfway to the valley floor, Leia heard rapid hoofbeats up ahead, and a moment later, Kip rode up.
"Yuuzhan Vong, they're climbing out of the valley."
He pointed down through the trees.
"Just there,
at that stand of broadleafs." Han rose up on his stirrups and motioned to an outcropping of rocks below the next switchback.
"Looks like a decent ambush point."
Kip nodded. "That's my thinking, too." They hastened through the switchback and into a gulch, where Sasso and Paige were waiting. Furfur led the mounts away, and everyone else scrambled to take up firing positions in the boulders on both sides of the trail. Han, Leia, Paige, and Melikyu on one side, Ra, Sasso, and Kip on the other. Han sighted down the barrel of the military blaster. Paige did the same with the DC-15 rifle. Melikyu wrapped her huge hand around the wooden grip of the antique sidearm. Leia took hold of her lightsaber, but didn't activate it. Shortly, they heard the patrol approaching. First to appear were a trio of Bisseps hounds. Low-bodied creatures, they moved in a waddling motion, their long snouts sniffing the air and ground, and their clawed feet leaving distinctive tracks in the dirt. Behind them walked three Yuuzhan Vong warriors armed with amphistaffs and bandoliers of thud and razor bugs. Two were sporting shoulder-mounted tactical villips. Behind them came three warriors on riding beasts, as large as Gruchina, but as sedate as Rontos.
"I'll take the tracker on the right," Paige whispered to Han. "You take the one in the middle. Go for the villips first."
The Bisseps lifted their snouts toward the boulders, just as the first blaster bolts were raining down on them. Han's and Paige's shots blew the two small villips to pieces, while sizzling red bolts from across the ravine knocked two warriors from their mounts. But even though taken by surprise, the Yuuzhan Vong were quick to counterattack. Razor and Thudbug swarmed into the air, and rearing and snarling, the three Bisseps surged up into the rocks. By then, Han, Paige, Leia, and Melikyu were already in motion, firing on the run and scampering for new positions. A bolt from Han's heavy blaster shattered the skull of a charging Bissep. A second bolt caught one of the trackers squarely in the chest, blowing a smoking hole in the warrior's Von Dune crab armor and sending him flying backward to be trampled underfoot by a confused Quinac. Kip front-flipped down onto the trail ahead of the patrol. Lightsaber ignited, he fought his way through a hail of razor bugs to take the fight to the remaining warriors. Han was astonished to see the Jedi's blade neatly cleave a rigid amphistaff, then, on the reverse stroke, sever the head of the warrior himself. Still on the rocks, Leia was similarly engaged in fending off a stream of frenzied bugs. Melikyu was cowering below her, afraid to show her head. Pulling the frightened Hodin to her feet, Leia led her to a safer position, whirling twice to send return flights of bugs smashing into the rocks. Han emerged from the boulders to see Kip kick a Kufi out of the hand of the only Yuuzhan Vong left standing, then pierce the warrior through the neck as he was running for his mount, as if in an attempt to flee. Six Yuuzhan Vong, two lizard hounds, and one Quinac lay sprawled in the dirt. Han squatted down beside the warrior he had shot in the chest, then regarded the 30-year-old weapon that had supplied the lethal bolt.
"I never knew these old blasters packed such a wallop."
"They don't," Kip said, from where he was crouched near another warrior. He wrapped his knuckles against the breastplate of the Yuuzhan Vong's living armor. Inferior armor, inferior weaponry, inferior troops.
"Let me get this straight," Ra said. "You're disappointed because we won too easily?"
He snorted a laugh.
"I'm beginning to wonder if all of you aren't sympathizers."
"He's right," Paige said. "We can use every bit of luck we get."
"I've played enough Sabacc to know luck when I see it,"
Han said. And this wasn't it. He scanned the boulders and nearby trees. They could be luring us into a trap. Kip glanced at him. Something else is going on here. Rimward of the Tian hegemony, Jaina watched the Yuuzhan Vong Armada revert from hyperspace once again. One moment, it appeared that 10,000 stars had been eclipsed. The next, that part of the galaxy had gained a new star cluster. Despite the glowing threat assessment screen and her previous sightings of the Armada, Jaina was staggered by the sheer number of ships the Yuuzhan Vong had amassed. Jaina pressed her chin to the helmet's microphone stud. Quirmia Controller, this is Twin Suns 1. The Beast has arrived.
Can you corroborate the Beast's current vector?
Jaina keyed a short request to the R2-B3 droid, which replied with tones and buzzes that became text on the display screen. Bearing toward jump coordinates for Mon Calamari.
Copy that, Twin Suns 1. You are green to depart. And reposition to Mon Calamari Extreme. Rendezvous at Iceberg 3, with Vanguard, Scimitar, and Rogue Squadrons.
Jaina signed off the command net and switched over to the tactical frequency. All pilots, this is Twin Suns Leader. Instruct your droids to set coordinates for Mon Cal Extreme. Jump to light speed at my zero count. 10, 9, 8, 7. Jaina sat back in her chair and waited for the X-Wing's in-com hyperdrive to engage. The jump would be Twin Sun's third and final since they had first observed the Armada emerge from hyperspace. Alliance Command hadn't expected an Armada to use the transit jump points, and now every fleet strategist was pondering why the Yuuzhan Vong hadn't jumped directly from the trade route to the Mon Calamari system. Had the enemy committed another tactical blunder, or were they merely testing the waters? Perhaps they suspected that the Alliance had positioned forces at jump points convenient to Mon Calamari, in the hope of outflanking the Armada once the battle commenced. The transit to Mon Calamari would also be the longest of the three, so Jaina took advantage of the lull to center herself in the Force. Having set her inner chrono to rouse her before the X-Wing reverted from hyperspace, she returned to full awareness just seconds before Cappy signaled her with a ready tone. She took a calming breath and waited for the stars to reappear. Mon Calamari Extreme was just that. The far reaches of the star system, where the Armada would likely decant. Iceberg 3 was the code for the penultimate of the system's 8 satellites. A misshapen chunk of frozen waste. In fact, a captured comet, destined at some point in time to collide with the outermost planet. Silhouetted against the small white spheroid were dozens of Alliance cruisers, destroyers, and carriers, along with hundreds of starfighters. This is actually going to happen, she told herself with a stubborn measure of disbelief. The end of the war and the fate of the galaxy might well be decided over the course of the next few days.
Welcome back, Twin Suns Leader.
A recognizable voice said into her helmet earphones. Thanks, Wedge, she said.
Hey, Styx!
Another familiar voice said. Jaina opened the channel to Gavin Darklighter. How long have you been sitting here, Rogue One?
Too long. Was intelligence correct about the number of Vong ships?
I think they underestimated. The comm fell eerily silent, then erupted in chatter as the Yuuzhan Vong war vessels began to emerge. Cones and polygons, faceted and smooth, bone white to reddish black, craggy with plasma launchers or strung with coral skippers. More rapidly and in increasing numbers they came, filling local space and eventually blotting out Mon Calamari's distant sun. Just when it seemed that the last of them had reverted, still more appeared. To Jaina, the final arrangement more closely resembled a flaring star or perhaps the spiral-armed galaxy the Yuuzhan Vong were determined to overwhelm. But whatever the Armada's form, Beast was the description that fitted best. Then, the immense organism was on the move, tentacles elongating from the hub as the cluster advanced on Mon Calamari, acutely aware of the reception party that awaited it, but resolute in its purpose.
All group and squadron leaders,
a male voice announced over the battle net.
Seed ships have arrived.
Alliance Command might have borrowed the term from the Yuuzhan Vong, but the reference was not to the vessels that initiated the process of world shaping. It was to the several dozen unarmed and remotely piloted freighters that gushed from behind Iceberg 3 and launched straight for the Armada. Plasma missiles assaulted the bulky container ships from all quarters,
though armor plating kept most of them intact until they were within the embrace of the longer tentacles. There they surrendered their payloads of thousands of probe droids. With wide-domed heads and dangling mechanical legs, the probots were marine in appearance, and indeed, they spread out like a school of deep-sea creatures riding the currents of a rising tide. Normally, the Yuuzhan Vong wouldn't have wasted firepower on droids, but each probot had been programmed to mimic the propulsion signatures of Alliance starfighters. So the coral skippers and pickets had a field day, slagging the probots with fiery projectiles, or simply dismembering them by collision. The Alliance might as well have been providing the Yamists and coral skipper pilots with practice for acquisition and targeting. But in fact, each probot was contributing invaluably to Alliance Command's goal of clearing fire lanes to the heart of the Armada.
"Your droid should be receiving navigational and targeting information,"
the voice of control said into Jaina's right ear.
"Watch your display screens for assignments."
Data began to flash on the cockpit display as Cappy deciphered the information forwarded from Mon Calamari. Jaina watched a graphic representation of the Yamisk resolve on the screen, with each tentacle of skips and gunboats assigned a number or letter. Twin Suns, Rogue, and Vanguard squadrons were tasked with taking out tentacles 14 through 20. But as impatient as she was to go to guns, there was an order to battle that had to be maintained. The first assault wave was comprised of A-Wings, TIE Interceptors, Chiss Clawcraft, A-9 Vigilances, and a handful of Y-Wings. The objective of the fastest of the starfighters, the A-Wings and A-9s, was to tease the coral skippers out of formation. The perimeter of the shifting armada became a blur of roiling fireballs and fragmenting vessels. Packets of green energy and Nova-bright bundles of explosive power began to eat away at the suddenly flailing tentacles. Molten ejecta rocketed outward at the attackers in such abundance the armada might almost have been hemorrhaging. Jaina switched over to the battle net in time to hear Control issue the order to withdraw.
"We have clear fire lanes to their capital ships at 1, 6, 7, 8, 12, and 22. All starfighters in those lanes repositioned to escorts and carriers."
Jaina licked the sweat from her upper lip and punched the X-Wing's throttle, leading Twin Sun swiftly into the fray. Remotely controlled by however many Yamists were contained in the core, the tentacles slithered and snapped like amphistaffs. Skips moved in and out of her targeting reticle faster than she or even Cappy could keep track of them. Behind the X-Wings flew B-Wing fighters and a squadron of TIE defenders. Coral skippers with enough fight left in them began peppering the X and B-Wings with plasma nodules and marshaling their Dovin basals to make grabs for the attackers' particle shields. Then, without warning, capital ships at the heart of the armada funneled furious firestorms along the depleted lanes. Jaina's X-Wing wobbled and tumbled through a swirling corridor of flames. With the starfighter's shields all but incinerated, she rammed the control stick to one side to free herself, rolling out of volcanic heat with the ship nearly roasted, and Cappy's dome, a drooping hood of molten alloy. She performed a desperate pushover and scanned local space, dismayed to discover that almost all of the TIE defenders were gone, atomized by the superheated tempest. The Beast hadn't been stunned by the initial assaults. It had merely been waiting for the right time to counterpunch. And the single blow it delivered had knocked 50 or more starfighters out of the fight. Jaina was doing a count of Twin Suns when the Armada Yamists instructed the tentacle arms to rotate clockwise, and full chains of coral skippers and pickets quickly filled the gaps. Where moments earlier, Jaina was facing six wounded skips, she suddenly found herself in the sights of a ravenous 30. Several hours of mostly downhill trudging brought Team Melocu to a low ridge that overlooked the southern portion of Kalula City and the prominent hive-like Yuuzhan Vong Minshal that harbored the Yamisk.
"There are three entrances," Sasso explained from the spot of cover the team found. "Two in the front and one on the east side. All of them are dilating membranes that can be pierced by blaster bolts. Guards are stationed at each, usually three or four at any given time. The garrison is made up of about 75 warriors."
Leia gazed out over the flat rooftops of the simple city. Judging by the position of the sun, the team was in for a long wait. Furfur volunteered to find a place to conceal the Timbus. He rose, but had scarcely moved off when a gurgling exclamation of surprise rang from just inside the tree line. Everyone whirled at once to see the Rin staggering toward them, his belly open like a ripe fruit. Behind him emerged four relatively short and dark-complected Yuuzhan Vong warriors. Han shot Leia the briefest of astonished looks and drew his blaster. Page did the same with his rifle, but he hadn't even lifted it to firing position when it was whipped from his grip by one of the longest amphistaffs Leia had seen and hurled through the air like a twig. Sasso was already charging the enemy wielding the amphistaff, but he didn't get 3 meters when the warrior leapt over him and, on landing, whirled and thrust the kufi deep into the Rodian's back. Kip and Leia ignited their lightsabers at the same instant. Continuous fire from Han and Ra had driven two of the warriors to the ground, but neither had been hit. Kip raced for the nearest one, catching the warrior across the chest with a powerful upswing of his blade. The Yuuzhan Vong growled and rolled, but his dark, unarmored flesh showed only a shallow, bloodless furrow. Kip whirled and brought the blade down like an axe. Evading the strike, the warrior rose to one knee and unfurled his amphistaff. The serpent-like creature elongated and wrapped itself around the hilt of the lightsaber. But Kip wasn't about to surrender his weapon. In a virtual tug of war with the creature, he spun and backflipped, but to little effect. At the same time, a second amphistaff lassoed him around the waist and arms and yanked him roughly to the ground. Han put 3 bolts into the second warrior, driving him 2 steps backward with each, but without killing him or persuading the amphistaff to loosen its constricting hold on Kip. Han yelled for Ra's help, but in a glance saw that the Bothan was trying desperately to keep the other pair of warriors from grabbing Paige. Without really thinking about it, Leia judged that Han and Kip were in greater jeopardy. Holding her blade at her right hip and pointed slightly downward, she moved against the warrior whose amphistaff was flinging Kip from side to side. Han felt rather than saw Leia race past him.
"Leia!"
he screamed, firing constantly while he rushed to catch up with her. A quartet of bolts holed the warrior Leia had targeted. But at once, the other warrior commanded his amphistaff to withdraw from the pommel of Kip's lightsaber and fly toward Leia. Seeing what was coming, Han dived forward in a frantic attempt to place himself between Leia and the attenuating weapon. Leia watched in horror as the amphistaff struck Han solidly in the neck, and not merely with its rounded head. The jaws of the living weapon gaped, and it sank 2 long fangs into Han's flesh. Han landed hard on his side, but quickly got to his knees. He managed to squeeze off 3 more bolts before the blaster slipped from his trembling hand. He slumped backward on his heels in shock, then tipped to one side, his body curling inward, with his shaking hands close to his chest. Kip raced forward, only to be set upon by 3 of the warriors. Leia's mouth fell open in a silent scream. She dropped the lightsaber and ran to Han, gazing in horror at the 2 punctures in his neck. She viced his spasming right hand between hers.
"Han," she cried. "Han!"
Melocu was suddenly by her side, lifting Han's head from the ground. His face was a bloodless mask of pain and sorrow.
I knew from the start this wasn't my war, he stammered.
"Han!"
Leia said, wide-eyed with terror.
"No, no,"
Leia said, shaking her head back and forth. Han extended his hand to her, but a warrior kicked it aside. Han's eyes rolled up, his eyelids fluttered, and his body went limp. Leia was still in shock when the surviving warriors led her, Kip, Paige, Ra, and Melocu into the Yamask installation. Sasso and Furfur had been left to die in the forest. Han, they dragged behind by his wrists like a slaughtered animal. He was alive, but unconscious or comatose from the venom delivered by the warrior's amphistaff. Even in her dread, however, Leia was not too oblivious to notice that only 1 weary guard was posted at the Min Shal's eastern dilating membrane, and that the membrane itself looked thin and weak and oozed a viscous liquid. The guard struggled to rise as the warriors approached. Barely strong enough to cross his arms and salute, he said something to them in a feeble voice.
"He's telling them that the commander is waiting," Paige translated quietly.
One of the warriors stumbled a bit as they crossed the threshold into the gloomy interior of the Min Shal.
Oddly, he was the only one of the warriors who hadn't been wounded during the brief action. Kip noticed the stumble as well. Something's not right. He received a hard jab in the ribs for speaking. Inside, the smell of rot was overpowering. Dead flipnats littered the ground. A female shaper was borne into the antechamber on a litter, carried by two more of the squat, dark-complected warriors. Her skin was as pale green as Leia's falsely colored face, and the many-fingered hand that had been grafted to her wrist hung limply at her side. The warrior shoved Leia and the others forward and rolled Han onto his back nearby. Leia's heart leapt when she saw him stir. The shaper was addressing the warriors from atop her litter.
"She's congratulating them on capturing us," Melikyu whispered to everyone. "She says we will contribute greatly to the sacrifice."
The shaper called two of the troops forward and spent a long moment looking them over, inspecting their faces, limbs, and torsos. One of the warriors indicated a tumor-like growth on his neck and dropped to one knee at the foot of the litter in what appeared to be humiliation.
"What's going on?" Kip asked Melikyu. She listened for a moment.
"The warrior thinks he has become a shamed one because his body is rejecting some sort of enhancement he received."
Melikyu listened for a moment more, then added,
"The shaper is telling him he is not shamed, that the growth of the tumor has nothing to do with the gods, and everything to do with this world. Everything to do with Kalula."
"Kalula?" Paige repeated in bafflement. The warrior looked relieved. The shaper was speaking again. Leia recognized the word, Yuuzhan Tar. Melikyu translated,
"She's ordering the special warriors, the Slayers she calls them, to return to Coruscant immediately. She says it's imperative that she apprise her master of what has happened here to render everyone ill. She is promising the Slayers that the commander is going to see us personally."
With the Armada's rotation, the distal ends of several tentacles had whipped themselves into ensnaring loops. Starfighters trapped in the loops twisted and swerved to avoid scudding coral skippers, but they were fast running out of maneuvering room. The overwhelmed deflector shields of Jaina's X-Wing were barely viable, and Cappy was probably beyond repair. A numbing explosion jolted the ship. Jaina glanced out the right side of the triangular canopy to see the mated ends of the starboard S-foils disintegrate and the laser cannon go whirling off into space. The power of the blast sent the starfighter into a wing-over-wing roll that the fusel thrusters and attitude jets were unable to correct. Flights of coral skippers pinwheeled in front of her, and fireballs geysered inward on spiraling trajectories. Jaina's flailing right hand found the inertial compensator and dialed it to maximum. As the cockpit instruments came back into focus, she saw that the display screens were white with noise. The battle net was unadulterated static.
"Round a bearing. Ecliptic."
Jaina tweaked the comm controls to find a clearer frequency.
"On squadron leaders and withdraw."
Withdraw, Jaina thought. Fine for those pilots who could, but scores of fighters were incapacitated, many in worse shape than Twin Suns 1. By then, the Armada had moved well past the system's captured comet and was bearing towards Sep Elipon, a ringed gas giant with more than 30 small moons. Auxiliary battle groups in advance of the tentacled cluster were already beginning to disperse, in part to deflect the battle from Mon Calamari itself, but also to convey the impression that the Alliance had recognized that it was outmatched and was on the run, determined to save as many of its ships as possible. A third surge of plasma spewed from the Armada Corps. Jaina called on the exhausted thrusters to propel the X-Wing out of its tumble and through a broad bank. At the same time, she reset the inertial compensator and got her bearings. The fighting was the most intense at the perimeter of the fluttering tentacles. Alliance frigates and corvettes were trading fusillades with Yuuzhan Vong escort vessels and cruiser analogs, Matalocs, opening dozens of new fronts along the flanks of the cluster. Starfighters and coral skippers pursued one another through blinding volleys of fire as the capital ships continued their long-distance duels. Even so, the Armada managed to maintain its Yamask shape. Then, without warning,
three groups of enemy war vessels peeled away from the core, carrying countless coral skipper tentacles with them.
Three battle groups have detached from the main cluster.
Alliance Control reported over the battle channel.
Coral skippers are withdrawing, monitoring the new cluster for possible micro-jump to Mon Calamari.
Jaina watched the smaller of the two clusters streak sunward and disappear.
Enemy secondary has jumped, waiting for verification of hyperspace vector.
Jaina's breath caught in her throat. If the new cluster jumped directly to Mon Calamari... Then the voice of control returned.
Vector confirmed. Secondary flotilla has jumped for the Perlemian trade route. Holonet transceiver ships at Quirmia Transit Point are under attack. Primary flotilla is accelerating for Sep Elipon and Mon Eron. All starfighter wings, regroup.